This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Taylor Branch, who I've never met before. His landmark trilogy on Martin Luther King consisted of Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. A couple years back, he came out with The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. And in 2011, he published a controversial cover story for The Atlantic entitled The Shame of College Sports, which he later adapted for an e-book called The Cartel, maybe an actual book, as far as I know, about the NCAA. Taylor Branch, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Nice to be here.
Well, it's a delight. You know, when you read an author for many years and then get a chance to meet the author, I think it's a fun experience for interviewers like me and for readers who go to see authors when they do book signings. So looking forward to our conversation. If you wouldn't mind, give me a little bit about your background.
I'm a native of Atlanta, Georgia, born in 1947. My dad was a dry cleaner. I grew up resolutely anti-political or non-political. Except for the fact that the civil rights movement went on all around me during my entire formative years and finally overwhelmed my fear and my desire to stay out of it because it was there all the time. I was in first grade of the Brown decision. I was a college senior when Dr. King was killed. And all my formative years in between, it was relentlessly pounding away on the fundamental issues of equal souls and equal votes and what does it mean to be an American. And so it turned my life's interests around.
Big questions. But I read in something you wrote that, you know, growing up you were kind of like my son, just interested in football and girls in high school.
Truly was. That, my dad, believe it or not, raised us on the maxim that anyone interested in politics can't find honest work, which is so strikingly contemporary now. He'd fit right in with the Republican Party. But that was kind of the mood then. You know, it was an optimistic era after World War II. There was plenty to do. I wanted to be a surgeon and everything. But here it was this movement growing up on the other side of town with people. It finally broke through to me when I saw 6-year-olds marching to jail in Birmingham. And I said, my goodness, if they're doing this and singing the same songs I sing in Sunday school, I'm missing something.
And your parents, what was their view on race?
My dad was a business type. They both were considered liberal in the sense that they would chastise you if you used any harsh epithets, if you were nasty, if you were racist. My dad believed that hard work was the solution to everything. My mom was an early, like, UN person. She actually joined some, not sit-ins, but she joined some of the Partners for Progress groups. So she was from Birmingham and grew up in Birmingham, but was a bleeding heart liberal even in her era. So she was my inspiration.
Hmm. And did they live to see your trilogy come out?
My dad did not live to see the last book of the trilogy come out. My mom's still going strong at 88. My wife's mother just turned 100. So I hope we have, of course, that's not in my bloodline, but there is some longevity in our family.
Well, we all should be so lucky. tell me when you decided to just dive straight into this civil rights chronicle that you devoted so many years of your life to?
Well, I always knew that that's what I wanted to write about because that's for personal reasons. That is what captured my interest in politics. When I got into book writing, I kept asking the editors, can I do King now? And when I was starting out, they said, no, you know, those are hard books to sell. People don't buy books about race. You don't have enough of a track record.
Don't buy books about race. That was an interesting response.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And finally, I had to do 4 or 5 books before I could get a publisher to I knew it was going to be a longer. All my books had been 1-year contracts. I signed up for a 3-year contract, which was a really big deal, having no idea it would take me 24 years. I thought it would take a little longer than 3, but I couldn't afford to tell the publisher that. I couldn't even afford to tell my wife that because they wouldn't have liked it. But so that was 1982. I started writing books in 76, and it was 82 before I could get a contract to start on the King years.
I'm speaking with Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the Martin Luther King trilogy, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. What, you know, the civil rights movement you write about, and I just read a talk you gave, or a op-ed on a talk you gave on the 40th anniversary of King's death, a great piece that appeared in the New York Times. And if you're listening, you can Google it and find it, Taylor Branch on the 40th anniversary of King's assassination. What are a couple of the lessons that come out of this? One thing that you said in that was the civil rights movement really was a democracy movement, and I thought that was an important point. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Absolutely. Dr. King himself said it's never just about race, it's about right and wrong, and as he put it, it's about equal souls and equal votes. And where those two very, very basic principles intersect. It accounts for one of the great miracles about Dr. King, which is that he preached about church and state every day, often two and three times, and yet was never attacked for mingling church and state, which is really remarkable given how many enemies he had. I mean, many liberals were not comfortable with Martin Luther King. Let's not kid ourselves. He was being denied university campuses, audiences right up to the end of his life. And yet nobody attacked him for mingling church and state because he did it with such genius. He didn't try to subordinate one to the other. He said, take your pick. Either way, equal souls or equal votes, we're not living up to our fundamental professed values. And they're about democracy, really, or about true Christianity, true ecumenical religion. Right. Take your pick how you come to it. And that makes it very profound, and it's something that's overlooked about King.
And equality. I mean, it's right there in equal souls, equal voices. What did he mean by equality?
He meant equality in essence, the same thing that makes us not really think that everybody's votes count the same thing, whether they're a billionaire or a homeless person off the street. That's a really radical concept that most people who've ever drawn breath would think was ridiculous. But equal in essence and equal in humanity and equal in partnership, that we are, as he put it, tied in a single garment of destiny and that we have to work together, is a pretty profound concept. And as his career went on, he risked I don't believe that he changed his fundamental beliefs over the course of his career, but I think he risked more and more to try to leave a witness behind, even when he was pretty confident it was not going to take hold. Selma was the last movement in his life that really took hold in the country. The rest of his life was witness in the North against war and against poverty.
Yes, certainly. You know, that big speech he gave at Riverside Church in 67 against the Vietnam War, there he expanded equality to equality for people all over the world, really. And I think that was what was one of the things that was tugging at him, if he really believed what he was preaching about equality and what we and his concept of nonviolence, of course. How can you support a war when you're a believer in a Nobel Prize winner for nonviolence?
I think his speech about nonviolence when he accepted the Nobel Prize is one of the most overlooked great state papers in modern history. He said basically that nonviolence is an ignored tactic that should be used for experimentation in every field of social conflict, including the relation between nations, because it's uniquely adapted to address the three great scourges of mankind: war, poverty, and racism, which he called violence of the mind, of the body, and violence of the spirit. And what he's saying is that nonviolence, which is not really very much discussed, is we're blind to the fact that it's at the heart of democracy. If you consider that what's at the heart of democracy is the vote, that democracy is just a great cathedral of votes, and a vote is nothing but a piece of nonviolence. So King was very profound in things that we just glide over and gloss over, that the civil rights movement was about refining democracy. It was about taking your religious values seriously, and that it had tremendous power. It's basically the power that makes us all attune alike to the same call of conscience. You know, that's where nonviolence comes from. That's where its power comes from. And we ignore it at our peril. And I think one of the great problems in the modern world is that we are still racially not able, not capable, not accustomed to think of Dr. King and the civil rights movement as leaders for the entire country and indeed the entire world in that era. We want to think of them as doing things just for black people or doing things just for black folks or just for that era and for quaint problems like where do you sit on a bus. But in fact, in that era, they were leading all of us. Just like Jefferson and Lincoln and anybody else, they were modern founders. They were confronting hierarchy and converting it into equal citizenship. And that's about as patriotic as you can get.
Speaking with Taylor Branch, the author, of course, of Parting the Waters, for which you won the Pulitzer Prize, one third of the trilogy that also consists of Pillar of Fire and At Canaan's Edge. The other thing that you noted in this 40th anniversary commemoration op-ed and talk that you gave was that the civil rights movement brought to or clarified for the first time, well, helped clarify anyway, as it did FDR, that the government can play a positive role, and that there's been this right-wing reaction to the idea of government playing a positive role ever since. And we certainly hear it today. I mean, we see it states after state. Certainly, it had to do with Scott Walker, you know, winning his hideous recall election in Wisconsin and other states. And it's been just kind of a Republican trope forever. And Reagan said, you know, government is the problem, not the solution. But certainly, for people who were active in the civil rights movement or wanted Social Security or wanted unemployment insurance or wanted Medicare or Medicaid, government is the solution.
Absolutely. Well, patriotism from the very beginning, from George Washington forward, is about what you can build. That's what makes the flag wave, what you can do together. That's the promise of it, not being anti-government. So you're absolutely right. I think our politics are still atrophied and paralyzed by the fact that they are defined by reaction to the 1960s. We have still not digested it. It was a time of hope when we said we can confront our most difficult and intractable problems, i.e. race and segregation. And we did. But we did it through politics, not without a lot of travail and a lot of failure. But when it was no longer respectable to uphold segregation, people made it respectable to cuss the government that forced us to deal with minorities that we didn't like. And it created the vocabulary of resistance and of cynicism. We're still dealing with that. And people are blind to the obvious fact of its power and the power of race. People sit around here today and say, is race over? I mean, there's no more ridiculous notion. Think of it this way. In 1964, race and the Civil Rights Act turned the partisan structure of national politics on its head in 1 year by creating the first Republicans in the South, where they hadn't been for 100 years. When I grew up in the South, Republicans meant Yankee. They were as scarce as polar bears because it meant Yankee, and we were the party of segregation and Democrats. And 80% of Republicans in Congress in 64 voted for the Civil Rights Bill. It was the party of Lincoln. In 1 year, as soon as Goldwater says, I'm against the Civil Rights Bill, the future was born. Republicans turned themselves, adopted really from George Wallace, a lot of the language against tax and spend liberals and big governments and pointy-headed bureaucrats telling us what to do and all that. George Wallace was a genius of political invention. So we're still dealing with the hangover of the 1960s, that we don't understand the patriotism of it. We don't know how to define our progress in racial terms that we're comfortable with.
And you've said that it's been just caricatured to death. The 60s is just a bunch of old hippies running around with, you know, no clothes on and long hair.
Well, that's exactly what happened a century ago after the Civil War. people, there was a reaction against race. People didn't want to deal with it, to the point that I was taught that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery and that the Klan was a noble enterprise to redeem the South by restoring white supremacy. Race does funny things with people's interpretation of very big issues, including the capacity of politics and our history. But one point I would like to make, we're on Progressive Radio. It's easy for us to say that conservatives are cynical and that conservatives have adopted an anti-big government language that has paralyzed and corrupted our politics. That's true. But liberals were important in buying into cynicism about government, too. We were the first people to make liberal a term of derision because radicals thought that liberals were the ones who temporized through the civil rights movement and made the Vietnam War. It was all liberals. It was all Kennedy liberals, McNamara and so on and so forth. People in SNCC that had gone to jail, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who had gone to jail for the right to vote for 5 years, opposed the Voting Rights Act, saying that if the federal government was involved, it couldn't be any good. And we loathed the federal government for making the Vietnam War.
But and liberals did help make the Vietnam War.
But we, in reaction to that, we have cussed liberals ever since from the left, too. Liberal was a term of derision on the left before George Wallace made it a term of derision on the right. And we still have some of the aftermath of that. We're against anything that the government might do. We're particularly against national security, perhaps for a good reason. But you know,
I think you're making a good point because my boss, my former editor, Irwin Knoll, who was the editor of The Progressive for 21 years, the worst thing you could call him was a liberal. He would never identify as a liberal, and he would get up on his haunches and say, you know, don't you dare call me a liberal.
Yes, but liberal in the sense of liberal democracy, meaning that democracy is liberal in essence compared to monarchy and all the, and every form of autocracy that had populated the earth, is something that's vital to understand as a balance to conservative and make democracy work. And we don't do it. I mean, people stand up there and buy into conspiracy theories on the Kennedy assassination, on the Martin Luther King assassination. Dexter King said James Earl Ray was innocent because the government killed might. Well, if you say that and you want to believe that the government is so evil that it's involved in all these conspiracies, how can you hold up the civil rights movement's promise that we can work miracles through government?
And you have no dispute that James Earl Ray was the lone was doing it by himself.
Well, I have no doubt that he did it without any conspiracy that would be satisfying to Oliver Stone.
Right. It wasn't the FBI who did it.
It was a truck stop conspiracy of a few fellow rednecks. It was not some helicopter company owner calling J. Edgar Hoover and the CIA and doing a hit.
Okay.
But if you believe in that kind of conspiracy, you have poisoned and closed off your mind to the optimism and patriotism of the civil rights movement.
Very interesting. Taylor Branch is my guest today. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Parting the Waters, and part of the trilogy that consists also of Pillar of Fire and At Canaan's Edge. He also wrote The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, and he's got a book that raised some hackles in the sports world called The Cartel, or a cover story for The Atlantic that preceded it, The Shame of College Sports. And we might get to that as well. What would King say if he were alive today, do you think?
Well, it's easy. First of all, I'm always reluctant to speak for him because I'm asked to do that. That's really a tough thing. I think that the only thing that's safe to say is that he would repeat his standard line that we've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go. I think he'd be very disappointed that given the riches and the freedoms that truly are marvelous for women, for gay people, for disabled people, that really, in my view, and I think he would say, grew out of the fundamental. When you start wrestling with fundamental issues of what freedom can do, miracles occur. And he himself said that it would free not only black people, a black-led movement, but it would free the white South. Which was the, you know, wasn't even fit for professional sports when it was segregated. It had no sports teams. My mayor in Atlanta, Ivan Allen, said that the instant the Civil Rights Bill passed, we in Atlanta built a stadium on land we didn't own with money we didn't have for a team we hadn't found, but within a year got the Milwaukee Braves to move to Atlanta. The South grew into the Sun Belt, and Southern politicians were no longer stigmatized and able to run for national office. So the Civil Rights Movement let loose a lot of freedoms. That's one part of our paralysis in politics, is that we don't know how to take credit for that because we're worried that black people will resent the fact that we're diluting their impact, that they did it for themselves. And black people are reluctant to claim all of these benefits that went not only all around the United States but all around the world. I mean, you had a nonviolent revolution against the Soviet Union and South Africa, for God's sake, instead of our nuclear Armageddon. And we're not saying those are our principles at work. So we really have hidden our light under a bushel here because we're so confused about race and the legacy of the 1960s.
Do you think he would be surprised? Were you surprised that the United States was able to elect a black man as president of the United States?
Yes. I think he would be surprised that it happened this quickly. But still, he would be smart enough to know that this is not nirvana. This doesn't mean we've settled the race issue. I mean, the amazing thing about Americans is that most people hold two utterly contradictory thoughts in their minds at the same time. One is that race is solved, and the other is that race is insoluble. Which is why our prisons are full and our schools are dysfunctional and our cities are dysfunctional. And what unites those two ideas, that it is solved and it's insoluble, is that both of them allow you not to think about it and say we might as well not talk about it. And as long as that's true, we are victims of our own separation and our own timidity politically and intellectually.
It's just denial. People don't want to deal with it.
People don't want to deal with it, but it's there.
What's your assessment of Obama?
I tend to think where I give him credit is that I do think that we've reduced our politics to consumers so that we expect the president to carry the whole burden of change, and that he is contending with the cumulative effect of two generations now of government anemia and cynicism about what we can accomplish. So I'm not sure he could have done a whole lot. And within that context, I think he's done fairly well. I wish he had done better. I wish at times he has almost framed this notion that to say that the only thing we can do is have the government fold up its tent and go home and have everybody contend to ourselves is not patriotism, and that we are going to rue the day sometime when we don't have not exercised our muscles of public trust and self-government and working together the way we did in the 1960s. He says that at times, but he does not frame the mission as well as I thought he could.
Yeah, sometimes he talks about community in powerful ways and the role of government, and he makes the positive case for it. By the same token, he's done so many things like the wars and these drone attacks and the civil liberty stuff with the National Defense Authorization Act. I mean, it's been so frustrating to me and I think to other progressives. And then half a loaf with health care, but who, you know.
Well, on health care, I don't think he could have done any better than he did. And there, I do think that I hope that he and other people around him will do a better job in selling exactly what it is. Most people still don't understand it, and that's part of the task. People in the civil rights movement knew when you fail, you do a demonstration, you go to jail, and nobody pays attention. It's still your job to figure out why they didn't pay attention and to figure out how to get through them and devise something else that will amplify that message. And that's what we need to do. But
you could have front-loaded the benefits, too. If you weren't a parent who had a kid between 21 and 26,
exactly,
you didn't feel it as much as we're supposed to feel it come 2014, and that's a hard sell.
Exactly. Well, I don't know whether he could have done that or not. I mean, maybe he could have, but there was political resistance to it. It's awfully hard to know. It's kind of a yin-yang. If you think that the political atmosphere didn't change enough to make things possible, or whether things were possible and we just weren't smart enough to figure it out. I don't really know.
It's interesting, Taylor Branch, because your Clinton book is all about political resistance. From that very first page where or first anecdote where Clinton is saying, you know, we woke up from the inauguration and the issue of gays in the military was on the front page, and it wasn't something that we expected to talk about. So it's an interesting task. Now, the Clintons, you had a personal tie with. Talk about that.
Well, from the anti-war period, when I'd worked for the moratorium and various anti-war, this is in the Vietnam era when I was a student, I met Clinton. He was always the conservative wing of the anti-war movement who would report in these gatherings on what Fulbright was thinking, because people thought Senator Fulbright, the chairman of the, who was a noted dove, might have some small chance to end the war in the Senate. And Clinton would report on that. I knew him just well enough that when I was asked to go to Texas, and they said, would you work with this guy named Bill Clinton in Texas in the McGovern campaign in 72? I said, I'd be happy to. And he called up and said, let's go, and can I bring my girlfriend Hillary, and let's get an apartment together. So I lived with the two of them from June until the end of November in 72 in a disastrous campaign. I mean, we got clobbered in Texas.
What were they like back then, though?
More or less younger versions of what we've got now. Hillary and I, in many respects, were more attuned to our generation. We were disillusioned by the fact that Watergate didn't register with the American public when it was obvious what it was, that the Vietnam was still dragging on and all this, and disillusioned that we worked our tails off on all these principled issues in Texas, spent most of our time refereeing disputes over who rode where in the motorcade and, you know, petty things. And Clinton told me then, Bill Clinton was more on automatic pilot. He loved that and so on and so forth. And when I complained to him about how we were reduced to all this petty stuff and got our tails kicked in the middle of a campaign about with so many fundamental issues of war and peace, he said, Taylor, if you want to deal with fundamental issues of war and peace, you got to build up your capacity to handle disputes over who rides where in the motorcade, because that's human nature. And I thought at the time that was just his ambition and automatic pilot talking, but there was a lot of wisdom in that too.
He still had a lot of ambition too. That drove
absolutely
him a lot too. Hillary, do you think she'll ultimately run for president in 2016?
People assume that she won't. I don't think she wants to. On the other hand, I know Hillary fairly well. I've been in touch with her lately. Clinton, by the way, was furious with me for my book because of its portrayal of Hillary, that I put Hillary in there a lot, coming in to say she just had a dream about Henry Kissinger at 2 in the morning, things like that, that he thought was unbecoming for the Secretary of State of the United States. But I do think that Hillary is above all a dutiful person, and if she's the best candidate for the Democrats in 2016, she will have a hard time saying no, that she's not going to run.
And she may want to make history as the first woman president as well.
Quite apart from what she wants to do.
She may feel that as a duty.
She may feel, yeah, that's true. She is a really duty-bound, very, very thoughtful person. When I interacted with them behind the scenes, keeping this diary secretly, and very proud of the fact that we managed to keep the diary late at night for all 8 years, she was the one that was always arguing the fundamental constitutional issues. He was saying, oh, that's just politics.
Fascinating conversation. Taylor Branch has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Matt.
Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the trilogy about Martin Luther King, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. And he tells me that he's going to come out with a volume, a shortened volume, for teachers and kids in the classroom. Thanks so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.